their backyard. What it does down the block, they don't care about. I wonder what Dad thinks of that. Not much, I'll bet, Granger opined. Not hardly, Jack agreed. So, you track the secured accounts to follow the bad guys and their money? That's the idea. It's a lot harder than you might imagine, but when you score big. So I'm going to be a bird dog. That's right. If you're good enough, Granger added. Mohammed was almost directly overhead at that moment. The Great Circle route from Mexico City to London passed close enough to Washington, D.C. for him to look down from 37,000 feet and see the American capital laid out like a paper map. Now, were he a member of the Department of Martyrdom, he might have climbed the spiral stairs to the upper level and used a gun to kill the flight crew and dive the aircraft. But that had been done before. And now the cockpit doors were protected, and there might well be an armed policeman up there in business class to spoil the show. Worse yet, an armed soldier in civilian clothes. Mohammed had little respect for police officers, but he'd learned the hard way not to disregard Western soldiers. However, he was not a member of the Department of Martyrdom, much as he admired those holy warriors. His ability to seek out information made him too valuable to be thrown away in such a noble gesture. That was good, and that was bad. But good or bad, it was a fact, and he lived in the world of facts. He would meet Allah and enter paradise at a time written by God's own hand in God's own book. For the moment, he had another 6.5 more hours of confinement in this seat.
More wine, sir?
The pink-faced stewardess asked. What a prize she might be in paradise.
Ah, yes, thank you,
he replied in his best Cambridge English. It was contrary to Islam, but not to drink would look suspicious, he thought again, and his mission was much too important to risk. Or, at least, so he often told himself, Muhammad admitted to himself with a minor chink in his conscience. He soon tossed off the drink and then adjusted the seat controls. Wine might be contrary to the laws of Islam, but it did help one sleep.
Michelle says the twins are competent for beginners, Rick Bell told his boss.
The tracking exercise? Henley asked.
Yeah.
He didn't have to say that a proper training exercise would have entailed 8 to 10 cars, 2 aircraft, and a total of 20 agents. But the campus didn't have anything approaching those assets. Instead, it had a wider latitude in dealing with its subjects, a fact which had advantages and disadvantages. Alexander seems to like them. He says they're bright enough, and they have mental agility.
Good to know.
Anything else happening?
Rick Pasternak has something new, he says.
What might that be? Jerry asked.
It's a variant on succinylcholine, a synthetic version of curare. Shuts down the skeletal muscles almost immediately. You collapse and can't breathe. He says it would be a miserable death. Like taking a bayonet through the chest.
Traceable? Henley asked.
That is the good news. Esterases in the body break the drug down rapidly into acetylcholine, so it's likely to be undetectable, unless the target happens to croak right outside a Primo medical center with a very sharp pathologist who's looking for something out of the ordinary. The Russians looked at it, would you believe it, back in the 1970s. They were thinking about battlefield applications, but it proved to be impractical. It's surprising KGB didn't make use of it. It'll look like a big-time myocardial infarction, even on a marble slab an hour later.
How'd he get it?
A Russian colleague was visiting with him at Columbia. Turned out he was Jewish, and Rick got him talking. He talked enough that Rick developed a delivery system right there in his lab. It's being perfected right now.
You know, it's amazing the Mafia never figured it out. If you want somebody killed, you hire a doc.
Goes against the old school tie for most of them.
But most of them didn't have a brother at Cantor Fitzgerald
who'd ridden the 97th floor down to sea level one Tuesday morning.
"Is this variant better than what we have already?"
"Better than what anyone has, Jerry. He says it's almost 100% reliable if used properly."
"Expensive?"
Bell shook his head. "Not hardly."
"It's tested? It really works?"
"Rick says it killed 6 dogs, all big ones, pretty as you please."
"Okay. Approved."
"Roger that, boss. Ought to have them in 2 weeks."
"What's happening out there?"
"We don't know," Bell admitted with downcast eyes. "One of the guys at Langley is saying in his memos that maybe we hurt them badly enough to slow them down, if not shut them down, but I get nervous when I read stuff like that. Like the 'there's no top to this market' shit that you get before the bottom falls out. Hubris ante nemesis. Fort Meade can't track them on the net, but maybe that means they're just getting a little smarter. There's a lot of good encryption programs out in the market, and 2 of them NSA hasn't cracked yet. At least, not reliably. They're working on that one a couple of hours every day with their big mainframes. As you always say, Jerry, the smartest programmers don't work for Uncle anymore.
They develop video games," Hendley finished the sentence. The government had never paid people well enough to attract the best, and that would never be fixed.
"So, just an itchy nose."
Rick nodded.
"Until they're dead, in the ground, with a wood stake through the heart, I'm going to worry about them."
"Kind of hard to get them all, Rick."
"Sure as hell.
Even their personal Dr. Death at Columbia couldn't help with that."
Chapter 6 Adversaries. The 747-400 touched down gently at Heathrow 5 minutes early at 12:55 p.m. Like most of the passengers, Muhammad was all too eager to get out of the Boeing widebody. He cycled through passport control, smiling politely, availed himself of a washroom, and, feeling somewhat human again, walked to the Air France departure lounge for his connecting flight to Nice. It was 90 minutes to departure time, and then 90 minutes to his destination. In the cab, he demonstrated the sort of French that one might learn in a British university. The cab driver corrected him only twice, and on checking into the hotel, he surrendered his British passport, reluctantly, but the passport was a secure document which he'd used many times. The barcode strip found on the inside of the cover page of the new passports troubled him. He didn't have that feature, but when it expired in another 2 years, he'd have to worry about some computer tracking him wherever he went. Well, he had 3 solid and secure British identities, and it was just a matter of getting passports for all 3 of them and keeping a very low profile so that no British police constable would check into those identities. No cover could ever stand up even to a casual investigation, much less an in-depth one, and that barcode could someday mean that the immigration officer would get a flashing light on his panel, which would be followed by the appearance of a policeman or two. The infidels were making things hard on the faithful, but that was what infidels did. The hotel did not have air conditioning, but the windows could be opened, and the ocean breeze was pleasant. Mohammed hooked up his computer to the phone on his desk. Then the bed beckoned him, and he succumbed to its call. As much as he traveled, he had not found a cure for jet lag. For the next couple of days, he'd live on cigarettes and coffee until his body clock decided that it knew where he was at the moment. He checked his watch. The man meeting him would not be there for another 4 hours, which, Muhammad thought, was decent of him. He'd be eating dinner when his body would be expecting breakfast. Cigarettes and coffee. It was breakfast time in Colombia. Pablo and Ernesto both preferred the Anglo-American version, with bacon or ham and eggs, and the excellent local coffee.
"So, do we cooperate with that towel-headed thug?" Ernesto asked.
"I don't see why not," Pablo replied, stirring cream into his cup. "We will make a great deal of money. and the opportunity to create chaos from within the house of the Norte Americanos will serve our interests well. It will set their border guards to looking at people rather than at container boxes, and it will not do any harm to us, either directly or indirectly. What if one of these Muslims is taken alive and made to talk?
Talk about what? Who will they meet, except some Mexican coyotes?
Pablo asked in reply. See, there is that, Ernesto agreed. You must think me a frightened old woman. Jefe, the last man who thought that of you is long dead.
That earned Pablo a grunt and a crooked smile.
Yes, that is true. But only a fool is not cautious when the police forces of two nations pursue him.
So, Efe, we give them others to pursue, do we not?
This was potentially a dangerous game he was entering into, Ernesto thought. Yes, he'd be making a deal with allies of convenience, but he was not so much cooperating with them as making use of them, creating straw men for the Americans to seek after and kill. But these fanatics didn't mind being killed, did they? They sought after death. And so, by making use of them, he was really doing them a service, wasn't he? He could even very carefully betray them to the Norte Americanos and not incur their wrath. And besides, how could these men possibly harm him, on his turf, here in Colombia? Not likely. Not that he planned to betray them, but if he did, how would they find out? If their intelligence services were all that good, they would not be needing his assistance in the first place. And if the Yankee and his own governments had not been able to get him here in Colombia, how could these people? Pablo, how exactly will you communicate with this fellow?
Via computer. He has several email addresses, all with European service providers.
Very well. Tell him yes. It is approved by the council. Not too many people knew that Ernesto was the council.
Muy bien, Efe.
And Pablo went to his laptop. His message went out in less than a minute. Pablo knew his computers. Most international criminals and terrorists did. It was in the third line of the email. And Juan, Maria is pregnant. She's having twins. Both Mohammed and Pablo had the best encryption programs commercially available. Programs which, the vendors said, could not be cracked by anyone. But Mohammed believed in that as much as he believed in Santa Claus. All those companies lived in the West and owed allegiance to their own homelands and to no other. Moreover, using programs like this only highlighted his emails for whichever watcher programs were being used by the National Security Agency, British Government Communication Headquarters, GCHQ, and French Director General Security Exterior, DGSE. Not to mention whatever additional unknown agencies might be tapping into international communications, legally or not, none of whom had any love for him and his colleagues. The Israeli Mossad would certainly pay a lot to have his head atop a pike, even though they couldn't know of his role in the elimination of David Greengold. He and Pablo had arranged a code, innocent phrases that could mean anything, which could be couriered around the world to cutouts who would then deliver them. Their electronic accounts were paid by anonymous credit cards, and the accounts themselves were in large and completely reputable Europe-based internet service providers. In its way, the internet was as effective as Swiss banking laws in terms of anonymity, and too many email messages transited the ether every day for anyone to screen them all, even with computer assistance. As long as he didn't use any easily predicted buzzwords, his messages should be secure, Mohammed judged.
So, the Colombians would cooperate. Maria was pregnant, and she was having twins,
The operation could begin at once. He would tell his guest this evening over dinner, and the process would begin immediately. The news was even worth a glass of wine or two, in anticipation of the merciful forgiveness of Allah. The problem with the morning run was that it was more boring than the society page of an Arkansas newspaper. But it had to be done, and each of the brothers used the time to think, mainly about how boring it was. It only took half an hour. Dominic was thinking about getting a small portable radio, but he'd never do it. He never managed to think about such things when he was in a shopping mall. And his brother probably enjoyed this crap. Being in the Marines had to be bad for you. Then came breakfast. "So, boys, are we all awake?" said Pete Alexander. "How come you don't break a sweat in the morning?" Brian asked. The Marines had many inside stories about the Special Forces, none of them complimentary and few of them accurate. "There are some advantages to getting old," the training officer replied. "One of them is taking it easy on the knees." "Fine. What's today's lesson plan?"
"You lazy bastard," the captain didn't add.
"When are we getting those computers?"
"Pretty soon."
"You said the encryption security is pretty good," Dominic said. "How good is pretty good?"
"NSA can crack it, if they direct their mainframes to it, for a week or so, and brute force it. They can crack anything given the time to apply. Most commercial systems they can already break. They have an arrangement with most of the programmers," he explained. "And they play ball, in return for some NSA algorithms. Other countries could do it too, but it requires a lot of expertise to understand cryptology fully, and few people have the resources or time to acquire it. So, a commercial program can make it hard, but not too hard if you have the source code. That's why our adversaries try to relay messages in face-to-face meetings or use codes instead of ciphers. But since that is so time inefficient, they're gradually getting away from it. When they have time-urgent material to transfer, we can often crack it."
"How many messages going across the net?" Dominic asked. Alexander let out a breath.
"That's the hard part. There are billions of them. And the programs we have to sweep them aren't good enough yet. Probably never will be. The trick is to ID the address of the target and key in on that. It takes time, but most bad guys are lazy about how they log on to the system, and it's hard to keep track of a bunch of different identities. These guys are not supermen, and they don't have microchips wired into their heads. So, when we get a computer belonging to a bad guy, the first thing we do is print up his address book. That's like striking gold, even though they can sometimes transmit gibberish, which can cause Fort Meade to spend hours, even days, trying to crack something that isn't supposed to make any sense. The pros used to do that by sending names from the Riga phone book. It's gibberish in every language but Latvian. No. The biggest problem is linguists. We don't have enough Arab speakers. It's something they're working on out at Monterey and at some universities. There are a lot of Arab college students on the payroll right now. Not at the campus, though. The good news for us is that we get the translations from NSA. We don't need much in the way of linguistics.
So, we're not here to gather intelligence, are we? Brian asked. Dominic had already figured that one out.
No. What you can scare up, fine. We'll find a way to make use of it. But our job is to act upon intelligence, not to accumulate it.
Okay, so we're back to the original question, Dominic observed. What the hell is the mission?
What do you think it is? Alexander asked.
I think it's something Mr. Hoover would not have been happy about.
Correct. He was a nasty son of a bitch, but he was a stickler for civil rights. We at the campus are not.
Keep talking, Brian suggested. Our job is to act upon intelligence information, to take decisive action.
Isn't the term for that executive action?
Only in the movies,
Alexander replied. Why us? Dominic asked.
Look, the fact of the matter is that CIA is a government organization. A whole lot of chiefs and not enough Indians. How many government agencies encourage people to put their necks on the line? He asked. Even if you do it successfully, the lawyers and accountants nibble you to death like ducks. So, if somebody needs to depart this mortal coil, the authorization has to come from up the line, up the chain of command. Gradually, well, not all that gradually, the decisions went to the big boss in the West Wing. And not many presidents want that sheet of paper to turn up in their personal archives, where some historian might find it and do an exposé. So, we got away from that sort of thing. And there are not many problems that can't be solved by a single 45 bullet at the right time and place, Brian said, like a good Marine. Pete nodded again. Correct. So, we are talking about political assassination? That could be dangerous, Dominic observed. No. That has too many political ramifications. That sort of thing hasn't happened in centuries. And not very often even then. However, there are people out there who rather urgently need to meet God. And sometimes, it's up to us to arrange the rendezvous. Damn. This was Dominic. Wait a minute. Who authorizes this? Major Caruso asked. We do. Not the president. A shake of the head. No. As I said before, there aren't too many presidents with the stones to say yes to something like that. They worry too much about the newspapers. But what about the law? Special Agent Caruso asked, predictably. The law is, as I've heard one of you once say so memorably, if you want to kick a tiger in his ass, you'd better have a plan for dealing with his teeth. You guys will be the teeth.
Just us? Brian wondered.
No, not just you. But what others there might or might not be, you do not need to know.
Shit.
Brian sat back in his chair.
Who set this place, the campus, up?
Somebody important. It's got deniable authorization. The campus has no ties to the government at all. None, Alexander emphasized.
So, we'll be shooting people technically on our own.
Not much shooting. We have other methods. You will probably not be using firearms much. They're too hard to move around with airports and all.
In the field naked? Dominic asked. No cover at all?
You will have a good cover legend, but no diplomatic protection of any kind. You will live by your wits. No foreign intelligence service will have any way of finding you. The campus does not exist. It's not on the federal budget, even the black part, so nobody can trace any money to us. That's how it's done, of course. That's one of the ways we have of tracking people. Your cover will be as international businessmen, bankers and investment stuff. You'll be educated in all the terminology so that you can carry on a conversation on an airplane, for example. Such people don't talk much about what they're up to keep their business secrets close. So, if you're not overly talkative, it will not be seen as unusual.
Secret agent man, Brian said quietly.
We pick people who can think on their feet, who are self-starters, and who don't faint at the sight of blood. Both of you have killed people out in the real world. In both of your cases, you were faced with the unexpected, and both of you handled the situation efficiently. Neither of you had any regrets. That will be your job.
What about protection for us? The FBI agent again.
There's a get-out-of-jail-free card for both of you.
My ass, Dominic said again. There isn't any such thing.
A signed presidential pardon, Alexander clarified.
Fuck, Brian thought for a second. It was Uncle Jack, wasn't it? I can't answer that, but if you wish, you can see your pardons before you go into the field. Alexander set down his coffee cup. Okay, gentlemen, you'll have a few days to think this one over, but you'll have to make your decisions. This is not a small thing I'm asking of you. It's not going to be a fun job, nor will it be easy or pleasant, but it will be a job which will serve the interests of your country. It's a dangerous world out there. Some people need to be dealt with directly. And if we whack the wrong guy? Dominic, there is that possibility, but no matter who it is, I can promise you that you will not be asked to kill Mother Teresa's little brother. We're pretty careful about who we target. You'll know who it is, plus how and why we need to deal with him or her before we send you out. Kill women? Brian asked. That was not part of the Marine ethos. It's never happened, as far as I know, but it's a theoretical possibility. So, if that's enough for breakfast, you guys need to think it over. Jesus, Brian said after Alexander left the room. What's lunch gonna be like? Surprised? Not completely, Enzo, but the way he just said it like that. Hey, bro, how many times have you wondered why we couldn't simply take care of business ourselves? You're the cop, Enzo. You're the guy who's supposed to say, oh, shit, remember? Yeah, but that shoot of mine in Alabama? Well, I kind of stepped a little over the line some, you know? All the way driving to D.C., I thought over how I'd explain it to Gus Werner, but he didn't blink, even a little. So, what do you think? Aldo, I'm willing to listen some more. There's a saying in Texas that there's more men need killing than horses need stealing. The reversal of roles struck Brian as more than a little surprising. After all, he was the gung-ho Marine. Enzo was the guy who was trained to give people their constitutional rights before he slapped the cuffs on. That they were both able to take a life without having bad dreams later was obvious to the brothers, but this went a little farther than that. This was premeditated murder. Brian usually went into the field with an exquisitely trained sniper under his command, and he knew that what they did wasn't far removed from murder either. But being in uniform made it different. It put some sort of blessing on it. The target was an enemy, and on the battlefield it was everyone's job to look after his own life, and if he failed to do it, well, that was his failing, not that of the man who killed him. But this would be more than that. They'd be hunting individual people down with the deliberate intent of killing them, and that wasn't what he'd been brought up and trained to do. He'd be dressed in civilian clothes, and killing people under those circumstances made him a spy, not an officer of the United States Marine Corps. There was honor in the latter, but damn little in the former, or so he'd been trained to think. The world no longer had a field of honor, and real life wasn't a duel in which men had identical weapons and an open field on which to make use of them. No. He'd been trained to plan his operations in a way that gave his enemy no chance at all, because he had men under his command whose lives he was sworn to preserve. Combat had rules. Harsh rules, to be sure, but rules, even so. Now he was being asked to set those rules aside and become, what, a paid assassin? The teeth of some notional wild beast? The masked avenger from some old movie on Nick at Night? This didn't fit into his tidy picture of the real world. When he'd been sent to Afghanistan, he hadn't what? He hadn't disguised himself as a fishmonger on a city street. There'd been no city street in those goddamn mountains. It had been more like a big game hunt, one in which the game had weapons of its own, and there was honor in such a hunt. And for his efforts, he'd gotten the approval of his country, a combat decoration for bravery that he might or might not display. All in all, it was a lot to consider over his second cup of morning coffee. Jesus, Enzo, he breathed. Brian, you know what the dream of every cop is, Dominic asked? To break the law and get away with it? Dominic shook his head. I had this talk with Gus Werner. No, not to break the law, but just once. To be the law. To be God's own avenging sword, was the way he put it. To strike down the guilty without lawyers and other bullshit to get in the way. To see justice done all by yourself. It doesn't happen very often, they say. But you know, I got to do it down in Alabama, and it felt pretty good. You just have to be sure you're bagging the right mutt. How can you be sure? Aldo said. If you're not, you back off the mission. They can't hang you for not committing murder, bro. So, it is murder. Not if the mutt has it coming, it isn't. It was an aesthetic point, but an important one to someone who had already committed murder under the shelter of the law and had had no bad dreams about it. Immediately? Yes. How many men do we have already? Muhammad asked. 16. Ah. Muhammad took a sip of fine French white from the Loire Valley. His guest was drinking Perrier and lemon. Their language skills? Sufficient, we think. Excellent. Tell them to make preparations to travel. We'll fly them into Mexico. There they will meet with our new friends and travel to America. And once there, they can do their work. Inshallah, he observed. God willing. Yes, God willing, Muhammad said in English, reminding his guest what language he should be using. They were in a sidewalk restaurant overlooking the river, off to one side with no one nearby. Both men spoke normally, two well-dressed men over a friendly dinner, not huddled or conspiratorial in their demeanor. This took some amount of concentration, since some degree of conspiratorial posture came naturally to what they were doing. But neither of them was a stranger to such meetings. So, how was it to kill the Jew in Rome? It was very satisfactory, Ibrahim, to feel his body go slack as I cut his spine, and then the surprised look on his face. Ibrahim smiled broadly. It wasn't every day they got to kill a Mossad officer, much less a station chief. The Israelis would always be their most hated enemies, if not the most dangerous. God was good to us that day. The Green Gold mission had been a recreational exercise for Muhammad. It hadn't even been strictly necessary. Setting up the meat and feeding the Israeli juicy information had been fun, not terribly difficult even. Though it would not soon be repeated. No, Mossad would not let any of its officers do anything without overwatch for some time. They were not fools, and they did learn from their mistakes. But killing a tiger had satisfactions all its own. A pity he had no pelt. But where would he hang it? He had no fixed home anymore, only a collection of safe houses that might or might not be totally safe. But you couldn't worry about everything. You'd never get anything done. Muhammad and his colleagues didn't fear death, only failure. And they had no plans to fail. I need the meeting arrangements and so forth. I can take care of travel. Arms will be provided by our new friends? A nod. Correct. And how will our warriors enter America? That is for our friends to handle. But you will send in a group of three at first to make sure the arrangements are satisfactorily secure. Of course. They knew all about operational security. There had been many lessons, none of them gentle. Members of his organization peopled many prisons around the world, those who were unlucky enough to have avoided death. That was a problem, one which his organization had never been able to fix. To die in action, that was noble and courageous. To be caught by a policeman like a common criminal was ignoble and humiliating. But somehow his men found it preferable to die without accomplishing a mission. And Western prisons were not all that terrible for many of his colleagues. confining, perhaps, but at least the food was regular, and Western nations did not violate their dietary rules. These nations were so weak and foolish regarding their enemies, they showed mercy to those who gave them none in return. But that was not Mohammed's fault.
"Damn," Jack said. It was his first day on the black side of the house. His training in high finance had gone very rapidly due to his upbringing. His grandfather Muller had taught him well during his infrequent visits to the family home. He and Jack's father were civil to each other, but Grandpa Joe thought real men worked in the trading business rather than in the dirty world of politics. Though he had to admit, of course, that his son-in-law had worked out fairly well in Washington. But the money he could have made on Wall Street, why would any man turn away from that? Muller had never said that to little Jack, of course, but his opinion was clear enough. In any case, Jack could have gotten an entry-level job in any of the large houses, and probably worked up the line pretty fast from there. But what mattered to him now was that he had skipped through the financial side of the campus and was now in the operations department. It wasn't actually named that, but that's what it was called by its members. They're that good.
What's that, Jack?
NSA Intercept. He handed the sheet across. Tony Wills read it. The Intercept had identified a known associate of terrorists. Exactly what function he performed was not known yet, but he'd been positively identified from voice print analysis. It's the digital phones. They generate a very clean signal, easy for the voice print computer to ID the voices. I see they haven't ID'd the other guy. Wills handed the sheet back. The nature of the conversation was innocuous, so much so that one might wonder why the call had been placed. But some people just like to chat on the phone, and maybe they were talking in code, discussing biological warfare or a campaign to set bombs in Jerusalem. Perhaps. More likely they were just passing the time. There was a lot of that in Saudi Arabia. What impressed Jack was that the call had been picked up and read in real time.
Well, you know how digital phones work, right? They're always broadcasting the "here I am" signal to the local cell, and every phone has its unique addressing code. Once we identify that code, it's just a matter of listening in when the phone rings or the phone holder makes a call. Similarly, we can ID the number and phone of the inbound caller. The hard part is to get the identity in the first place. Now they have another phone ident for the computer to monitor.
How many phones do they keep track of? Jack asked.
Just over 100,000, and that's just in Southwest Asia. Nearly all of them are dry holes, except for the 1 in 10,000 that counts. And sometimes they can show real results, Wills told him. So, to bag a cold call, a computer listens in and keys on hot words?
Hot words and hot names. Unfortunately, so many people are named Mohammed over there. It's the most popular given name in the world. A lot of them go by patronymics or nicknames. Another problem is that there's a big market in cloned phones. They clone them in Europe, mainly London, where most of the phones have the international software. Or a guy can get 6 or 7 phones and use them once each before tossing them. They're not dumb. They can get overconfident, though. Some of them end up telling us a lot of things, and occasionally it's useful. It all goes through the big NSA-CIA book, to which we have access on our terminals.
Okay? Who's this guy?
His name is Uda bin Sali. Rich family, close friends of the king. The Big Daddy's a very senior Saudi banker. He has 11 sons and 9 daughters. 4 wives. A man of commendable vigor. Not a bad guy, supposedly, but he's a little too doting with his kids. Gives them money instead of attention, like a Hollywood big shot. Uda here discovered Allah in a big way back in his late teens, and he's on the extreme right of the Wahhabi branch of Sunni Islam. Doesn't like us very much. This boy we keep track of. He might be a gateway into their banking arrangements.
His CIA file has a picture. He's about 27, 5'8", slender build, neatly trimmed beard. Flies to London a lot. Likes the ladies he can purchase by the hour. Not married yet. That's unusual, but if he's gay, he conceals it well. The Brits have gotten girls into his bed. They report that he's vigorous, about what you'd expect for his age, and fairly inventive. Hell of a thing for a trained intelligence officer to do, Jack observed. Lots of services enlist the help of hookers, Wills explained. They don't mind talking, and for the right wad of cash, they'll do just about anything. Buddha here likes chicken in a basket. Never tried that myself. Asian specialty. Know how to call up his dossier? Nobody taught me, Jack replied. Okay. Wills frog walked his swivel chair over and demonstrated. This is the general index. Your access password is Southwest 91. Junior Dooley typed in the password, and the dossier came up as an Acrobat graphics file. The first photo was probably from his passport, followed by six more, in a more informal format. Jack Jr. managed not to blush. He'd seen his share of playboys while growing up, even in Catholic schools. Will continued the day's lesson. You can learn a lot from how a guy does it with women. Langley has a shrink who analyzes that in great detail. It's probably one of the annexes on this file. At Langley, it's called Nuts and Sluts Information. The doc is named Stefan Pisniak, Harvard Medical School professor. As I recall, he says this kid is normal in his drives, given his age, liquidity, and social background. As you'll see, he hangs out a lot with merchant bankers in London, like a new kid learning the business. The word is that he's smart, affable, and handsome. Careful and conservative in his money work. He does not drink. So, he is somewhat religious. Doesn't flaunt it or lecture others about it, but lives in accordance with the major rules of his religion. What makes him a bad guy? Jack asked. He talks to a lot of people we know about. There's no word on who he hangs with in Saudi. We've never put any coverage on him in his own backyard. Even the Brits haven't, and they have a lot more assets in place. CIA doesn't have much. And his profile isn't high enough to merit a closer look. Or so they think. It's a shame. His daddy's supposed to be a good guy. It'll break his heart to find out his son's hanging with the wrong crowd at home. With that wisdom imparted, Wills went back to his own workstation. Junior examined the face on his computer screen. His mom was pretty good at reading people from a single look, but it was a skill she hadn't passed along to him. Jack had trouble enough figuring women out. Along with most of the men in the world, he comforted himself. He continued to stare at the face, trying to read the mind of someone 6,000 miles away who spoke a different language and adhered to a different religion. What thoughts circulated behind those eyes? His father, he knew, liked the Saudis. He was especially close to Prince Ali bin Sultan, a prince and senior official in the Saudi government. Young Jack had met him, but only in passing. A beard and a sense of humor were the only two things he remembered. It was one of Jack Sr.'s core beliefs that all men were fundamentally the same, and he'd passed that opinion along to his son. But that also meant that, just as there were bad people in America, so there were also bad people elsewhere in the world. And his country had recently had some hard lessons from that sad fact. Unfortunately, the sitting president hadn't quite figured out what to do about it yet. Junior read on through the dossier. So, this was how it began here at the campus. He was working a case. Well, kind of working some sort of case, he corrected himself. Uda bin Sali was working at being an international banker. Sure enough, he moved money around. His father's money? Jack wondered. If so, his daddy was one very wealthy son of a bitch. He played with all the big London banks. London was still the world's banking capital.
Jack would never have guessed that the National Security Agency had the sort of ability to crack this kind of thing. 100 million here, 100 million there. Pretty soon you were talking about real money. Solly was in the capital preservation business, which meant not so much growing the money entrusted to him as making sure the lockbox had a really good lock. There were 71 subsidiary accounts, 63 of which were identified by bank, number, and password, so it seemed. Girls, politics, sports, money management, cars, the oil business. What did rich Saudi princelings talk about? That was a big blank spot in the files. Why didn't the Brits listen in? The interviews with his hookers hadn't revealed very much, except that he was a good tipper for those girls who'd shown him an especially good time in his house in Berkeley Square, an upscale part of town, Jack noted. He mainly got around by taxi. Owned a car, a black Aston Martin convertible, no less, but didn't drive it much, the British information revealed. Did not have a chauffeur. Went to the embassy a lot. All in all, it was a lot of information that revealed not very much. He remarked on this to Tony Wills. Yeah, I know, but if he turns up hinky, you can be sure there are two or three things in there that ought to have jumped off the page at you. That's the problem with this damn business. And remember, we're seeing the process take. Some poor schlub had to take really raw data and distill it down to this. Exactly what significant facts got lost along the way? No way to tell, my boy. No way to tell. This is what my dad used to do, Junior reminded himself, trying to find diamonds in a bucket full of shit. He'd expected it to be easier somehow. All right, so what he had to do was find money moves that were not easily explained. It was the worst sort of scut work, and he couldn't even go to his father for advice. His dad would probably have flipped out to learn that he was working here. Mom would not be overly pleased either. Why did that matter? Wasn't he a man now, able to do what he wanted to do with his life? Not exactly. Parents had power over you that never went away. He'd always be trying to please them, to show them that they'd raised him the right way and that he was doing the right thing. Or something like that. His father had been lucky. They'd never learned about all the things he'd had to do. Would they have liked it? No. They would have been upset, furious with all the chances he'd taken with his life. And that was just the stuff his son knew about. There were a lot of blank spots in his memory. Times his father hadn't been home, and Mom hadn't explained why. And so now, here he was, if not doing the same thing, then sure as hell heading in that direction. Well, his father had always said that the world was a crazy place, and so here he was, figuring out just how crazy it might really be. Chapter 7. Transit. It started in Lebanon, with a flight to Cyprus. From there, a KLM flight to Schiphol Airport in the Netherlands, and from there to Paris. In France, the 16 men overnighted in 8 separate hotels, taking the time to walk the streets and exercise their English. There had been little point in having them learn French, after all, and struggle with a local population that could have been more helpful. The good news, as they saw it, was that certain female French citizens went out of their way to speak decent English, and they were very helpful indeed, for a fee. They were ordinary in most details, all in their late 20s, clean-shaven, average in size and looks, but better dressed than was the average. They all concealed their unease well, albeit with lingering but furtive glances at the cops they saw. They all knew not to attract the attention of anyone in a police officer's uniform. The French police had a reputation for thoroughness which did not appeal to the new visitors. They were traveling on Qatari passports at the moment, which were fairly secure. But a passport issued from the French foreign minister himself would not stand up to a directed inquiry, and so they kept a low profile. They had all been briefed not to look around much, to be polite, and to make the effort to smile at everyone they encountered. Fortunately for them, it was tourist season in France, and Paris was jammed with people like them, many of whom also spoke little French, much to the bemused contempt of the Parisians, who in every case took their money anyway. The next day's breakfast hadn't concluded with any new explosive revelations, and neither had lunch. Both Caruso brothers listened to their lessons from Pete Alexander, doing their best not to doze off, because these lessons seemed pretty straightforward. "Boring, you think?" Pete asked over lunch. "Well, none of it's earth-shaking," Brian responded after a few seconds. "You'll find it's a little different in a foreign city, out on the street in a market, say, looking for your subject in a crowd of a few thousand. The important part is to be invisible. We'll work on that this afternoon. You had any experience in that, Dominic?" "Not really, just the basic stuff. Don't look directly at the subject, reversible clothes, different ties, if you're in an environment that calls for a necktie. And you depend on others to switch off on coverage. But we won't have the same backup we have in the Bureau for a discreet surveillance, will we?" "Not even close." "So, you keep your distance until it's time to move in. At that point, you'll move in as quickly as circumstances allow."
"And whack the guy?" Brian asked. "Still uneasy about it?"
"I haven't walked out yet, Pete. Let's say I have my concerns and leave it at that." Alexander nodded.
"Fair enough. We prefer people who know how to think, and we know that thinking carries its own penalties."
"I guess that's how you have to look at it. What if the guy we're supposed to do away with turns out to be okay?" the Marine asked.
"Then you back off and report in. It's theoretically possible that an assignment can be erroneous, but to the best of my knowledge, it's never happened.
Never? Not ever. Not once," Alexander assured him.
"Perfect records make me nervous. We try to be careful."
"What are the rules? Okay, maybe I don't need to know right now who sends us out to kill somebody, but it would be nice to know what the criteria are to write up some fucker's death warrant, you know?
It will be someone who has directly or indirectly caused the death of American citizens or is directly involved in plans to do so in the future. We're not after people who sing too loud in church or who have books overdue at the library."
"You're talking about terrorists, right?"
"Yep," Pete replied simply.
"Why not just arrest them?" Brian asked next.
"Like you did in Afghanistan?"
"That was different," the Marine protested.
"How?"
Pete asked.
"Well, for one thing, we were uniformed combatants operating in the field under orders from legally constituted command authority."
"You took some initiative, right?"
"Officers are supposed to use their heads. My overall mission orders came from up the chain of command, however."
"And you don't question them?"
"No. Unless they're crazy, you're not supposed to do that."
"What about when not doing something is crazy?" Pete asked. "What if you have a chance to take action against people who are planning to do something very destructive?"
"That's what CIA and FBI are for."
"But when they can't get the job done for one reason or another, then what? Do you just let the bad guys move ahead with their plans and handle them afterward?"
"That can be expensive," Alexander told him.
"Our job is to do the things that are necessary when the conventional methods are unable to accomplish the mission."
"How often?"
This was Dominic seeking to protect his brother.
"It's picking up."
"How many hits have you made?"
Brian again.
"You don't need to know."
"Oh, I do love hearing that one," Dominic observed with a smile.
"Patience, boys. You're not in the club yet," Pete told them, hoping they were smart enough not to object at this point.
"Okay, Pete," Brian said after a moment's thought. "We both gave our word that what we learn here stays here. Fine. It's just that murdering people in cold blood isn't exactly what I've been trained to do, you know?
You're not supposed to feel good about it. Over in Afghanistan, did you ever shoot anybody looking the other way?"
Two of them, Brian admitted.
Hey, the battlefield isn't the Olympic Games, he semi-protested.
Neither is the rest of the world, Aldo.
The look on the Marine's face said,
Well, you got me there.
It's an imperfect world, guys. If you want to try to make it perfect, go ahead, but it's been tried before. Me, I'd settle for something safer and more predictable.
Imagine if someone had taken care of Hitler back in 1934 or so, or Lenin in 1915 in Switzerland. The world would have been better, right? Or maybe bad in a different way, but we're not in that business. We will not be involved in political assassinations. We're after the little sharks who kill innocent people in such a way that conventional procedures cannot handle them. It's not the best system, I know that. We all know that. But it's something. And we're going to try to see if it works. It can't be much worse than what we have already, can it?
Dominic's eyes never left Pete's face during that discourse. He just told them something that maybe he hadn't meant to tell them. The campus didn't have any killers yet. They were going to be the first. There had to be a lot of hopes riding on them. That was a lot of responsibility. But it all made sense. It was plain that Alexander was not teaching them from his own real-world experience. A training officer was supposed to be somebody who had actually gone out and done it. That was why most of the instructors at the FBI Academy were experienced field agents. They could tell you how it felt. Pete could only tell them what had to be done. But why, then, had they picked him and Aldo?
I see your point, Pete, Dominic said. I'm not leaving yet.
Neither am I, Brian told his training officer. I just want to know what the rules are.
Pete didn't tell them they'd be making the rules up as they went along. They'd figure that one out soon enough.
Pete didn't tell them they'd be making the rules up as they went along. They'd figure that one out soon enough. Airports are the same all over the world. Instructed to be polite, they all checked their bags, waited in the correct lounges, smoked their cigarettes in the designated smoking areas, and read the books they'd purchased in the airport kiosks. Or pretended to. Not all of them had the language skills they would have wished. Once at cruising altitude, they ate their airline meals, and most of them took their airline naps. Nearly all of them were seated in the aft rows of their seating sections, and when they stirred, they wondered which of their seatmates they might meet again in a few days or weeks, however long it took to work out the details. Each of them hoped to meet Allah soon, and to garner the rewards that would come for fighting in their holy cause. It occurred to the more intellectual of them that even Mohammed, blessings and peace be upon him, was limited in his ability to communicate the nature of paradise. He'd had to explain it to people with no knowledge of passenger jet aircraft, automobiles, and computers. What then was its true nature? It had to be so thoroughly wonderful as to defy description, but even so, a mystery yet to be discovered. And they would discover it. There was a degree of excitement in that thought, a sort of anticipation too sublime to discuss with one's colleagues, a mystery, but an infinitely desirable one. And if others had to meet Allah too as a result? Well, that was also written in the Great Book of Destiny. For the moment, they all took their naps, sleeping the sleep of the just, the sleep of the holy martyrs yet to be. Milk, honey, and virgins.
Solly, Jack found, had some mystery about him. The CIA file on the guy even had the length of his penis appended in the nuts and sluts section. The British whore said he was grossly average in size, but uncommonly vigorous in application, and a fine tipper, which appealed to their commercial sensibilities. But unlike most men, he didn't talk about himself much. Talked mainly about the rain and chill of London, and complimentary things about his companion of the moment, which appealed to her vanity. His occasional gift of a nice handbag
Louis Vuitton, most cases, sat well with his regulars, two of whom reported to Thames House, the new home of both the British Secret Service and the Security Service. Jack wondered if they were getting paid by both